Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report, a special Friday edition for January 16th. I'm Lee Robartis. On today's program, we'll hear from mass shooting victim Terry Grabielski, interviewed about music on KRFP's Yin radio program last spring. We'll hear from Chuck Brocious of the Environmental Defense Institute on Governor Butch Otter's decision to accept nuclear waste. We'll hear from tomorrow's Latah County Human Rights Task Force Martin Luther King Jr. breakfast keynote speaker Bob Butler, and have an interview with newly elected Democratic State Representative Paulette Jordan of Plummer on her first week in the legislature representing District 5, Latah, and Benoit counties. But first, this news. Washington State University canceled College of Pharmacy classes for the day on its Spokane campus this morning after receiving an unspecified threat at about 9:30 a.m. A text alert to students told them not to come to the Pharmaceutical and Biomedical Sciences building in Spokane. The threat emergency was later lifted, but it was too late to remove the class cancellations. The Washington Supreme Court yesterday granted a new trial to a man serving 420 years for driving the car that convicted murderer Maurice Clemens was in after killings. The Supreme Court ruled because deputy prosecutors improperly told a jury Darkus DeWayne Allen was an accomplice if he, quote, should have known that a crime had been committed, the conviction should be overruled. Allen said he did not know Clemens' intentions when he drove him to downtown Lakewood on November 29, 2009, and got out and shot and killed four Lakewood police officers at a cafe. Allen went into a convenience store while Clemens went to the coffee shop. Allen said he did not know what happened in the coffee shop when Clemens returned to his car, and he only realized something had happened after he had driven a number of blocks and noticed Clemens was injured. Clemens then fled from the car, causing a massive manhunt in the Puget Sound area that ended with police killing Clemens. The High Court on December 24th reversed the convictions of Clemens' aunt, Latricia Nelson, and friend Eddie Lee Davis, who were convicted of helping Clemens elude police and possession of a stolen firearm. In those cases, the state Supreme Court ruled the trial courts imposed inappropriately long sentences. Lawmakers in the Washington House Public Safety Committee are considering a Democratic proposal to erase previous marijuana convictions for those who possessed less than 40 grams of the plant. Thurston County Public Defender Alex Fricks told the committee today, "The voters spoke. It is patently unfair to continue to punish people with the stain of a conviction for possessing a now legal substance, period." A new audit authored by the Legislative Services Office in Boise shows just over 50% of Idaho schools are not using their Idaho Education Network broadband internet services, part of the statewide broadband program for all schools in Idaho being built that has run into serious funding problems recently. According to the auditors, the program, started in 2012, has been in decline since its inception, giving legislators a reason to reconsider their efforts to fully fund its ongoing construction. Republican State Senator Dean Cameron of Rupert, who's co-chair of the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, said the report raises concerns. Legislative Services Office Manager April Renfro told the Idaho Statesman, "They're not utilizing these assets as much as we'd probably like them to. Overall, 47% is not a very high utilization rate." A judge ruled the $60 million contract null and void last year because close friend to Governor Otter Michael Gwartney of the Department of Administration changed the terms of the contract after bids were submitted. Unsuccessful bidder Syringa Network sued, and while the case was pending, the Federal Communications Commission stopped paying its three-quarters share of network construction costs. More recently, Idaho Governor C.L. Butch Otter has asked the state to rebid the contract and also asked legislators to allocate another $7.2 million to keep the program afloat for another year. The governor has hired former Republican State Senator John Getty of Coeur d'Alene on a temporary contract to be his point person in finding a solution for the network issue this session. Cameron was optimistic a newer, more efficient method of getting broadband into Idaho schools will come about as a result of the audit. Cameron said one of the silver linings of this storm is that we get to reevaluate the system. We have this opportunity, and I'm hopeful the legislature and the executive branch won't squander this opportunity. We have this opportunity to redefine this. The American Civil Liberties Union has announced a settlement between the FBI and former University of Idaho football player Abdullah Al-Kid in a wrongful detention lawsuit. Al-Kid said he was wrongly arrested following the 9/11 attacks when the FBI detained him and about 70 other Muslim men under an obscure law, which the government said was to ensure witnesses attend trials. In Al-Kid's case, the FBI wanted him to testify in the trial of University of Idaho graduate student Sami Al-Hussein, who was accused of aiding terrorism. Al-Hussein was found not guilty on the most serious charges against him and only convicted of visa fraud, and Al-Kid was never called to testify at his trial. Al-Kid spent 16 days in jail after being arrested while trying to board a plane to Saudi Arabia in 2003. He said he was never informed by the FBI he must come to court after he cooperated with authorities about the University of Idaho student. In order to get a warrant for his arrest, FBI agents told a judge Al-Kid only had a one-way ticket to Saudi Arabia, but it was later disclosed he had a round-trip ticket to the country where he planned to study Islam. According to the Associated Press, Al-Kid was given a settlement of $385,000 by the FBI, who offered their apologies as well. Republican State Representative Matt Shea of Spokane told a group of about 250 to 300 gun rights activists gathered on the steps of the state capitol in Olympia yesterday, Washington's new voter-approved background check law on guns is unconstitutional. Shea said, "An unconstitutional law is no law at all. God gave us that." Many at the rally openly carried a wide variety of guns and rifles on the north steps of the Capitol. The Washington Firearms Leaders Action Group says the rally is the first in a series the group plans statewide. Many of the ralliers went into the Capitol building with guns in their hands, where guns are legal, but protest signs with sticks on them are not. After the rally, the Washington Alliance for Gun Responsibility announced it will institute a grading system, much like the national rating the National Rifle Association gives lawmakers nationwide. The grading will encompass scoring on how legislators vote as well as how vigorously they advocate for gun issues. The legislature was not addressing the gun law issue yesterday, but Group President Ray Carter said the reason for the rally was to, quote, get our foot in at maintaining a presence in Olympia throughout the session. The Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee is considering offering recommendations to Latah County Commissioners related to a request for a water right for a proposed 10-acre organic produce farm near Idler's Rest Road outside of Moscow. Adam Reed of Moscow, who already operates a 5-acre urban farm within the Moscow city limits, is seeking a permit to use 13,000 gallons a day for the new organic farm operation, or about 30 million gallons per year during irrigation season. Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee Executive Director Steve Robichon said the operation may be able to get by with much less water. Latah County is operating under a groundwater management plan and can file official objections with the Idaho Department of Water Quality if they feel a project will mine the area's declining aquifers. University of Idaho administrators officially changed the name of the Student Union Building to the Bruce M. Pittman Center yesterday, eliminating the word union, which has been part of its moniker since at least the 1940s, previous to a number of expansions that created the current Student Union at the corner of 6th and Deacon Streets. The new name is in honor of Bruce Pittman, who retired in October after a 40-year career at the University of Idaho, mostly spent as dean of students. University officials, alumni, faculty, and friends honored Pittman in a ceremony at the building yesterday. Pittman started his career at the UI in 1973. He was at first the school's Greek advisor for 7 years and then was named dean of students in 1981. A longtime nuclear watchdog says Governor Butch Otter's deal with the Department of Energy to allow 50 nuclear fuel rods into the state for research will mean even more of one of the most dangerous substances in the world in Idaho. Otter and Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin made the deal with the DOE recently, and former Governor Cecil Andrus and Phil Batt blasted Otter and Wasdin for doing so at a press conference yesterday in Boise. I spoke with Chuck Brocious of the Troy-based Environmental Defense Institute this afternoon about the decision to bring more nuclear waste into Idaho. What type of research does the Department of Energy want to do at INL with these fuel rods?
Well, actually, that's a good question. The only thing we can understand from their past history is that they just aren't really interested in research and testing. They just want to put this waste somewhere besides where it is and send it to Idaho.
So any explanation as to what sort of research they're doing is a red herring as far as you're concerned?
It is. The problem is that there's no final disposal site for this type of high-level waste because the Yucca Mountain disposal site in Nevada was terminated. So this waste problem is building up at all the commercial reactors across the country, as well as the nuclear Navy. They've got a backlog. It's sort of like the proverbial waste constipation problem. And since Idaho seems to be willing to take more of this waste where it can't go anywhere else, that's where it's coming.
Now, the proposed deal, or the deal consummated, actually, by Governor Otter and Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin is to accept 50 of these fuel rods. Tell me about the fuel rods currently at Idaho National Laboratory and how many there are, and must they also be disposed of? They're part of the backlog then, right?
Well, this kind of waste is actually it's kind of like it's sort of counterintuitive, in as much as they call it spent nuclear fuel, but actually it's extremely radioactive, more so than even when it went into the reactor in the first place. This kind of material, if you had a small piece of it that could fit in the palm of your hand, you'd be dead within a half an hour. That's how dangerous it is. And it's currently in storage pools, which are in a constant cool water circulation situation, and it's very expensive for them to keep it in that kind of a storage process, which is absolutely required, because if the power goes out and the water coolant stops, it can turn into a criticality wherein there's an uncontrolled fire where these things heat up, and it's a kind of fire that can't be put out by ordinary water.
Is that what we call a meltdown?
It's a meltdown, yes.
And the fuel rods are in these ponds. I suppose they're cement ponds, Snake River Plain Aquifer area, and also in the earthquake zone. Okay, and these are from, at INL, these the rods that that are already there, aside from the ones that Governor Otter wants and the DOE want to bring to the state. There's a lot more than just 50, and what are these from, the reactor there at INL?
Yes, there currently are operating reactors. The advanced test reactor is currently operating and generating waste on a regular basis, and it has its own separate cooling ponds that are adjacent to the reactor, where the spent fuel is put in there for a period of time, where it is left for a number of years for the more reactive elements to cool off before it can be put into any kind of other, say, a dry storage scenario.
What do you think of former Governor Batt and former Governor Anders's criticism? It seems like they believe accepting the 50 more fuel rods will lead Idaho to becoming a nuclear dump site in exchange for a temporary economic boost. And they're just saying $20 million over 5 years.
Well, those governors have a long history of dealing with the Department of Energy's obfuscation of its obligation to deal with the waste issues, and it's been over five decades in developing, but former Governor Anders finally put his foot down when they tried to import spent nuclear fuel from Colorado into the state, and he sent the Idaho State Police out there to block the shipments, and that's where this whole legal process sort of started, and it extended into former Governor Phil Batt's administration in terms of developing a legal court ordered settlement agreement that was going to force the Department of Energy to get the high level waste out of Idaho by a time certain. Governor Anders and Governor Phil Batt fought tooth and nail to get that agreement through the court system and get the consent order, and they're understandably angered by current Governor Butch Otter's willingness to just throw that aside and take in more waste, when the Department of Energy simply hasn't fulfilled any of its agreements during the consent order. Well, the crucial points is as it relates to human health and the environment is that the when this waste comes into Idaho, it ends up in our aquifer and in the air when they try to process it. So it's not a kind of a isolated kind of material that we don't have to worry about, because it ends up in the waste stream.
Are there underground plumes heading towards the Snake River aquifer now?
That are actually in the Snake River aquifer as we speak.
And what's the impact on the quality of the water that's pumped there?
It's serious, extremely serious. And this is the kind of contamination that has very serious health implications. And the problem is that there's not the kind of research and examination that points to how it's impacting the users of that aquifer.
That was Chuck Brocious of the Troy-based Environmental Defense Institute speaking about Governor Otter's deal with the Department of Energy to accept 50 new nuclear rods into the state of Idaho. That was just announced this week. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. We'll be back in a moment. District 5 voters have sent two new legislators to Boise to represent Latah and Benoit counties in the House. They are Republican Carolyn Nielsen Troy of Genesee and Democrat Paulette Jordan of Plummer. I spoke with Jordan this afternoon to find out about her first week in the legislature and what she thought of Governor C.L. Butch Otter's State of the State address. Governor Otter's State of the State address, what do you think of his proposal to increase education funding? It looks like by well over $100 million this year.
Yeah, in our response as a Democratic caucus, I felt that, you know, we'll see it when we see it, and I'm hopeful that we'll actually see those numbers come down the pipeline to affect local schools rather than riding our schools on supplemental levies.
Do you think some Republicans might resist Otter on that?
No, I don't, but I don't imagine exactly where that money will come from without raising taxes in areas we wouldn't want to see taxes, or knowing that the tax cuts along with that proposal, you know, where would that make sense, because you have to pull money from elsewhere. And we definitely don't want to pull more from the general fund or money that would go towards education or even infrastructure at this point, but I know he expects that. He would like to see the legislature take a lead role on improving roads and transportation. But again, if you're proposing tax cuts for corporations, then you need to figure out where that money is going to come from to make up for that tax base.
Yeah, it sounds like the increase in education funding might come from the general budget, whereas the any increase that might happen in transportation funding or to fix the roads and bridges would come from something along the lines of fees, like for driver's licenses, gas tax, and things like that.
That's the discussion that was going on here, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, I am hopeful. You do want to stay optimistic in this field. But knowing that that range, $100 million, I'm just a little cautious as to where that will be coming from, if we have to sacrifice from other programs, other social services or needs of the community, because we definitely don't want to pull anywhere else. So especially if we're continuing to make those tax cuts for larger corporations or wealthier families.
And I suppose Otter's education proposal also includes the idea of funding the new licensing program for teachers and the merit-based pay raise system that was proposed by Governor Otter's Education Task Force. I was wondering what you know about that and what your thoughts are.
Yeah, the committees have not had that discussion yet, but I try to stay realistic when it comes down to what's really going to happen. And if you're making a proposal as large as that, and they've set up a very large number in the hundreds of millions for that increase in incentives and a merit pay for teachers, but really, will we have that money available? And if we do push this law through and allow it to become a function of teacher pay, will they follow through with that? Because we've learned before that even though they proposed a similar structure through a career ladder, they've never been able to fund it. And not to say that they've never been able to, that the money wasn't there. It's just that those in charge chose not to fund it.
Okay. Talking about other needs in the state, Governor, there's been a lot of resistance in the past couple of years with the legislature to expand Medicaid, which some studies would save the state a lot of money because there would be more federal money coming into the state. And now Governor Otter has said that he at least wants lawmakers to hold a hearing on expanding Medicaid. And do you see that as a breath of fresh air?
I do. I think it's nice to see that, the Democratic Party has had a major influence in that, especially when it comes to education as well, just constantly honing the message and bringing that information to light helps. So we know that the governor has been paying attention and definitely watching. And so I think that it is a breath of fresh air because we are basically seeing that he's paying attention. He's listening to the task force that he's created. And hopefully we'll see more support down the pipeline if he was able to use his leadership to influence the majority party to find a way and a means to support a bill that would allow us to have access to cover the gap.
You mentioned,
which means all those who are not covered under health care.
Okay. You mentioned tax cuts that Governor Otter is proposing earlier. It seems the tax cut would bring down the tax rate for the wealthiest Idahoans and corporations from 7.4% to 6.9%. At least that's what the governor's proposing. And we actually had a Democratic House Leader John Rushi saying that an improvement from previous tax cut proposals, which were a lot larger. Well, what are your thoughts on that particular issue?
I don't think they're necessary. I know that we've been hearing a lot from our director of the Department of Commerce here that he's noticed some great impacts and influence in the high tax cuts. And not entirely against them. As a businesswoman, I support businesses regardless, and by and large do want to see them thrive. But when you're sacrificing education on the same token, that's where I think we need to rethink our strategy in terms of how we want to create a better business environment for Idaho. So right now the tax cut that I see is not just the 6.9% that we're going to see come down the pipeline, but it's, you got to realize that that's in addition to other promises made from the previous 5 years. So it's going to be in addition to those other cuts, which means it's going to be, to me, if you add it all up, it'll be tremendous. But again, to me, I have to look big picture. How will this impact education? How will it impact our opportunities to build on mental health needs, behavior health, or even the social programs that we see with other functions in the state? Because as you go down that line, you know, obviously education receives the vast majority, but everything else has to take its fair share. And I would just hate to see those programs being minimalized each and every year from here on out.
You mentioned the needs as far as mental health funding, and I believe the mental health support issues will become an important discussion in Moscow, possibly after the murders this weekend. There are allusions that the alleged perpetrator had serious mental illness and maybe wasn't getting enough health. Do you want to talk about that sort of in the perspective of funding on the state level?
I'm really sensitive to the matter because it just, you know, for all of us, when something so tragic hits our community in such a way, we're all deeply impacted. So I really feel for the families and offer my condolences to all of them. But I do know that the question has been raised in regards to how could we have done better in terms of mental health and prevented such a matter. But, you know, you look at the person who did this random act, and I think, how could this have been prevented? And, of course, we've had many other shootings throughout the state within the past few months alone. So there definitely is a need, and I don't think that anyone in the state would realize that there isn't one. But how we address it, I know the governor pointed out that he went down to see the existing facility that was approved from last year's session, and I know that there is a great need that adding one other facility is not going to cut it. We definitely need to think on a grander scale in how are we going to make longer-term improvements rather than just building one facility at a time. I know that Moscow is doing a great job in expanding behavioral health needs, and they're doing it even on a very grassroots level. But I love that the community has come together, and they are strategizing as we speak and building up community to, one, improve the needs and address the mental health functions of those who need it most. But how we can get that funding to funnel down to the communities is going to be my concern. And what kind of money do we have? So I do know that we're going to be having this discussion in the next few weeks. Hopefully we'll be able to bring that to light as to the greater need, because it's one of those where in the past few days here in the legislature, we've all been watching what happened in Moscow and, you know, the effects of the surrounding community. And so everyone definitely is paying attention. And unfortunately, just out of tragedy, people are wanting to see a solution, which is good. But, it's just hard to see this happen to those families. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to have some solution by the end of the session, because we definitely need to address it. Funding-wise, I am not sure what we'll get, but hopefully we'll push for as much as we can get.
Okay. One other thing, Representative Paulette Jordan, this is your first week as a full-fledged lawmaker in the Idaho legislature, although you served as a substitute for a bit last year for Representative Shirley Ringo. I was wondering, if you've been down to Boise during the session before, other than the substitute, or since you're new, is some other Democratic lawmaker, maybe more of a veteran, taking you under his or her wing, as you know, and showing you how things are going down there? What do you feel your level of knowledge? Are you hitting the ground running?
Absolutely. Since the day of election, I've been meeting every night with every organization imaginable. We've had discussions from our district judges to social programs, education, meeting with schools, meeting with the administrative side of schools and teachers, obviously, and then businesses, local businesses, even individuals who have concerns. So every day since the election night, I've been meeting with folks, and it's been a very busy process, and I've been very appreciative because it's all educational. So that helped prepare me for when I come down here. The first week of December, the legislator offered an orientation session for all new freshmen who were elected this year. So there was 14 of us. We were all able to meet and get to know each other on a personal basis, get to go through the process of understanding ethics and the law, how we adjust and work through the legislature. For those who had no experience whatsoever, they were able to meet with other senior legislators who would come in and just offer similar advice that you're speaking of in terms of, this is what I went through, this is proper protocol, and even mentioned decorum, how we address each other. And then if we were even able to practice just the everyday process in the session. So voting-wise, there's a very strict protocol on the House floor. We were able to practice debate, and that was very helpful because when you get to the floor, it's very formal, so you want to make sure that you're following that line and making it easier for yourself and others to understand your position and then debate well for your district.
That was Democratic State Representative Paulette Jordan of Plummer speaking about her first week in the legislature in Boise this afternoon. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Michael Chin of Spokane, who was injured in Saturday's shooting spree in Moscow, is still recovering in a Spokane hospital, and his condition is reportedly improving. Police say 29-year-old John Lee of Moscow, who grew up as Kane Grabilsky, killed three people at three locations and injured Chin before fleeing to Washington, where he was apprehended. We now turn to some clips from one of the three people killed in the mass shooting last Saturday. Terry Grabilsky was alleged shooter John Lee's adoptive mother. She was found dead of gunshot wounds at her home on Veatch Street Saturday. Grabilsky was recently a singer for the band Henry C. and the Willards and occasionally sung with Simba and the Exceptional Africans. In the last year, Grabilsky was in the KRFP studios in May to talk on the Yin radio program with host Jerry Saylor. She spoke about the Moscow band she sang with during the 1990s called the Hot Flashes. Here are three brief clips from that interview.
I've sung with many groups on the Palouse. I've been very, very fortunate. You know, there's a really strong music community here, and it's just easy to kind of blend in with each different group. My main thing is I love doing harmony. I hear harmony better than I do the main melody. So it's always been kind of fun harmonizing with different other artists.
Do you come from a musical family?
Not at all. I never sang until I moved to the Palouse and met Donna, and we formed the Hot Flashes. That was back in my early 40s. And it was a huge change for me because I had spent 13 years living up in the mountains and wearing jeans and a t-shirt and chainsawing and mixing concrete in the back of a wheelbarrow. And here I met this fine group of women who got me into sequins and rhinestones and bouffant wigs, and it was a blast. Our generation was just ripe for doing something fun. We took songs from the 50s and 60s and changed the words to fit our message. Like, instead of singing, "You make me feel like a natural woman," we sang, "Soy makes me feel like a natural woman." And it was fun. I grew up the oldest of seven children. We were all within 9 years. And so I would volunteer to do the dishes so that everyone would leave and I would get the kitchen to myself and turn on music and sing and dance with the refrigerator. And I'm sure I'm not the only one of our generation who did that back with those old refrigerators where you could see a reflection. Part of the fun is entertaining. When you entertain, part of the nervousness goes away because it's not about you.
That was Terry Grabilsky, who was found shot to death last Saturday in her home on Veatch Street. She was interviewed on Yin Radio here on KRFP in May. The 61-year-old Grabilsky was a physician's assistant at Moscow Family Medicine's University of Idaho Student Health. Police say she was killed by her adoptive son, John Lee. The other two deceased victims in the shooting spree were 76-year-old David Trail, who was Lee's landlord, and the brother of former state representative Tom Trail, and 47-year-old Belinda Niebuhr, who was the manager of the Arby's restaurant in Moscow. National Association of Black Journalists President Bob Butler, who will be giving the keynote address at the Latah County Human Rights Task Force Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast Saturday, gave a talk on race, ethics, and the media yesterday at the University of Idaho. In the combined Whitewater and Clearwater rooms of the Idaho Commons, Butler told a capacity crowd about his organization's research on diversity in the media and how the lack of diversity behind the scenes can affect what we see and hear.
The station had a photographer go out and interview people in reaction to a drive-by shooting. And what they said was, you know, even a four-year-old boy, you know, saw this, and they talked to the kid, and the kid, aren't you afraid? The kid said, nah, I ain't afraid of nothing. Well, when you grow up, you're going to stay away from all these guns? The kid said, no, I'm going to have me a gun. Implication being, this kid's going to be a gangbanger. What they cut out of it was, I'm going to have me a gun, because I'm going to be the police. Changes the context a little bit, doesn't it? Don't you think? This particular station, I know for a fact that there's no diversity in management. They usually have diversity on the air. You can go to the station website and see the reporters of different backgrounds, men, women, different ethnicities. They promote them in billboards. You see the billboards when they promote, and you see them on the commercials. But when it comes to the managers, you don't see them. This is the on-air staff for the station that did this. You can see it's very diverse. I know several of the people that are there, you know. And several of those people actually called me and they were really upset. You don't find the managers, and you, for the most part, you have not been able to know who's calling the shots behind the scenes until now. I started this thing called the Diversity Census, in which I would actually look at every station owned by a particular company and find out what the diversity looks like. So this particular station in Chicago, which is 45% of that marketplace are people of color, that's what their management looks like. That's a problem. In a city with that much diversity and nobody behind the scenes calling the shots, that's why this happened. That's why they got that video on the air. So this report, 295 stations located in 134 different cities, 19 different companies, 150 of these stations, more than half have no diversity at all in management. Now, I got no problem if you have no diversity in Spokane. You know, hell, here in, where are we? Moscow, Pocatello, because you don't have much diversity in town. I got a big problem if it's in Chicago or New York or Washington, D.C., and that's what this report found out.
That was CBS radio reporter Bob Butler, who is also the president of the National Association of Black Journalists, speaking at the University of Idaho Commons yesterday afternoon. An audience member asked Butler how people should deal with the media after a situation like last weekend's triple murder rampage in Moscow. Here's Butler's reply.
We've had the case here in town, the triple murder. People are being told not to talk to the media, and how do I feel about that, being a reporter? I want you to talk to me. I want to find out what's going on. It's my job to find out what's going on. But I understand why some people don't want to talk to the media, especially when you tell them one thing and they misquote you, or they take your comments out of context. That happened. It just happened to me on the Cosby thing recently, where after he made those comments, I got a call from TMZ. A friend of mine, her niece works there. The niece calls me and asked me about it. It kept asking questions like, "Were you trying to get me to slam Bill Cosby?" I said, I'm not going to slam the man. I agree with what he said. You know, journalists ought to be open-minded and neutral. They should be unbiased. But that doesn't mean me not telling what people are saying about you. You know, I want to tell your side of the story too. Regarding what's happening here, I know it's very difficult. And I hope the families have somebody who will speak for them, because it gets very, very hard when you have a bunch of reporters, you know, all of a sudden doing, pardon my expression, we call it the gangbang, where all the reporters show up and you're all yelling questions. You see it on TV. It doesn't really happen that way, because usually in situations like that, people, they get surrounded and they can't get away. That's why the Suns have police escorts and things like that. The way I handle things like that is I'll go up to you. I have a recorder on my shoulder and a microphone in my hand. If I get the mic in this hand, I'm coming to talk to you, you know, because the mic is up and I'm usually already recording. Or I'll ask you if I can record. Usually, if it's sensitive, I put the mic under my arm and I walk up, and I'm not recording, and I'll just go talk to them, or I might leave my stuff in the car, and say, listen, I'm a reporter, you know, I'm here, offer my condolences, but I'm supposed to talk to people. Can I talk to you about, you know, what's going on here? And sometimes people will say yes, and sometimes they'll say no. You know, but that's what you have to do.
That was National Association of Black Journalists President Bob Butler addressing over 100 students at the University of Idaho yesterday. Butler will be the keynote speaker at the Latah County Human Rights Task Force Martin Luther King Jr. Human Rights Community Breakfast tomorrow at the Moscow Middle School on D Street. The event begins at 9 a.m. and tickets are available at the University of Idaho Office of Multicultural Affairs or Paradise Ridge CDs at 117 East 3rd Street in Moscow. There may be some tickets available at the door tomorrow. KRFP citizen journalist Al Chittister contributed to this story. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather from the National Weather Service. Mostly cloudy tonight, low 29. Tomorrow, 70% chance of precipitation. Snow likely, mainly after 2 p.m. Mostly cloudy, high 36. New snow accumulation, less than half an inch possible. 100% chance of rain Saturday night. Temperatures rising to around 40 by 2 a.m. And 30% chance of rain before noon on Sunday. Mostly cloudy, high 43. Southwest winds 15 to 20 with gusts up to 30 miles an hour. Sunday night, 20% chance of rain. Then a slight chance of rain and snow towards dawn. Mostly cloudy, low 34. Wind gusts from the southwest up to 20 and a 20% chance of rain and snow showers before noon on Monday. Then a slight chance of rain showers, mostly cloudy, high 39. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or go to the Radio Free Moscow website to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow. I'm Lee Robartis, Jim Roach, Alan Solon, Al Chittister, and Jerry Saylor assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP, Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse.